Episode 67 of the DFA Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me after a short break is my regular co-host, CBS Sports' RJ Anderson. RJ, thanks so much for returning to the show and unseating Craig from his temporary position.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed because I thought you had designated me for assignment and were in the process of shipping me elsewhere to Lord knows whatever baseball podcasts are out there. So a little disappointed, but I guess it's okay to be back and talking baseball with you again here as we're right here at the trade deadline.
I appreciate your enthusiasm for returning to the show. It's the time of year that's supposed to be the best for us. We've got a whole lot of stuff to cover because there have been so many trades. Even a couple of signings. We're going to kind of gloss over the injuries, I think, for this week because, you know, as much as we love guys like Aaron Judge and Chris Bryant and Yoenis Cespedes, it's just too much player movement to focus on anything other than that.
Yeah, and the injuries are always depressing to talk about because you don't want to see anyone get hurt and you don't want to see these teams at less than full strength for the stretch run. So we're trying to focus on the positive and the happier aspects of this podcast for this episode at least. And then in a week or two, we'll be back to misery and the endless march to the grave that baseball presents to us on a daily basis.
Well said, my friend. So we'll kick things off in our A block with what I think are two of the biggest deals that we have yet to talk about on this show. Both of them involving contenders in the National League Central as they kind of race for the top of that division. One of the really kind of the few really cool races that we've got left in a divisional context, I would say at this point, is the National League Central. And so both teams kind of in the mix for that made what I would consider a pretty big move. The first is being the Cubs going out and acquiring Cole Hamels. They traded Eddie Butler, right-handed pitching prospect Raleigh Lacy, and a player to be named later to the Rangers to acquire Cole Hamels and add another left-hander to the starting rotation. And kind of the counter move that was made was, if you could say that, but it's a very different kind of move, was the Brewers acquiring Mike Moustakas from the Royals. And in return, they sent Brett Phillips and Jorge Lopez out to Kansas City. So two moves, both of them I think are upgrades for these National League Central teams, but we'll kick off the conversation by asking you, RJ, which of the two moves do you think is the most interesting or do you like the most?
I would go with the Moustakas trade because I think the Brewers on paper are a worse team than the Cubs. So I think there was more impetus on them to go out there and make a deal. And I don't think they're done yet, frankly. I think they need to go out there and get a starting pitcher or two before the deadline passes, or, you know, at least before the waiver deadline itself passes. But realistically, they need to go out there and get a guy who's probably not a back-end starter, someone who has a little, you know, thump to their game. And, you know, Moustakas is not the solution that I think a lot of us had them pursuing because they already had a pretty good third baseman in Travis Shaw. But I like the creativity. And I like the idea of moving Shaw to second base to create room for Moustakas because, you know, that's a outside-the-box solution, and they certainly needed help up the middle. I mean, you know, Jonathan Villar just hasn't been good since his big 2016. Orlando Arcia, who I liked, has really, really struggled at the plate this season. And we can go through the list of guys they've tried slotting in, whether it's Tyler Saladino or Brad Miller or whomever. None of them have really performed up to par either. So this is a creative solution. I don't know how Shaw is going to take the second base defensively, but I like it. And I like the thought process there that leads you to this trade. With a Hamels trade, you know, I understand why Chicago did it. At the same time, I think there's a fair chance that maybe he's not even in their postseason rotation, or at minimum, that he's not one of their top three starters come October. So I get it. It's probably an upgrade for them. But I think in terms of importance, the Milwaukee deal is more important.
Yeah, let's focus on that one for a second because I found it really interesting that yesterday, you know, of course, Shaw played second base for the Brewers. And I like Mike Moustakas. I think Moustakas is a good player. He's hit well this season. You know, not outstanding, but well. He's a good defensive third baseman. But I found it really interesting that actually before the game yesterday, Moustakas took ground balls at second base. And I think it would be a lot more interesting for a lot of reasons if the Royals gave Moustakas the lion's share playing time at second base. He's got good footwork. He's a good defender. And with Moustakas hitting the open market in the offseason, if I were Mike Moustakas, I'd be kind of interested in proving that I could at least handle myself a little bit at that position to kind of perhaps maybe give teams another reason to want to sign me to a multi-year contract this offseason.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I remember back when Moustakas was a prospect, Keith Law used to suggest that the Royals should move him behind the plate. So it's kind of funny that at this point in his career, a year after a seeming breakout, he's starting to try other positions, and the other position is second base. But that's certainly an interesting wrinkle. And if that's the plan, then I guess it makes some sense, because if you think that Shaw and Moustakas are both equally suited to play second base, then you probably want to keep the guy who is a long-term fit at third base for you at the hot corner. But either way, I'm not sure how they're going to handle it defensively. And at the same time, I'm not sure it really matters because, the Brewers are one of the most analytically inclined front offices in baseball. I'm sure they're going to position these guys as well as they can. And if they're about equal, then, you're probably going to get a below average performance either way. But that's not why they're in the lineup. They're in the lineup to mash. And I think both of these guys have the potential and have shown on paper that they're above average hitters. So strengthens their lineup, but I really still want to see them go out and get some rotation help, don't you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ulys Chacin has been phenomenal over the last few days, and has been really underrated, I think, overall this season. But he can only take you so far. The combination of Anderson, Chacin, and Miley is probably their 1-2-3 starters at this point, and that's really lame compared to some of these other teams, especially when you look at the Cubs now, who are going to be slotting in Cole Hamels as what, their number five starter?
Yeah, I mean, you can make the case, yeah.
I mean, I would definitely at this point probably put the entirety of the rest of the rotation ahead of him with Hendricks and Lester and Quintana, and Darvish has been a real kind of wild card this season. I really don't know what to make of the season he's had up to this point, but I mean, I really just think that the Hamels acquisition is good. If it bumps Tyler Chatwood to the bullpen, then it's definitely a positive because he's been a train wreck. And I think it can only help this team going forward. But I do think the Cubs need really all the help that they can get to try to hold off the Brewers. They're the two best teams in the National League so far this season. And I think the Cubs could be in some serious trouble if they fall into that wild card game where anything can happen. I think you could see a quick exit, possibly, especially, they'll need some extra help with Bryant being on the DL at this point.
Yeah, and the Cubs trade is interesting for a number of reasons, beginning with the fact that, as you mentioned, he's probably going to bump Tyler Chatwood to the bullpen, and I believe we were both not huge fans of that deal because I thought there was the potential that Chatwood would be in the bullpen basically within a year, and it looks like we're at least heading in that direction. In the interim, with Hamels, he's interesting within himself because when you look at his overall numbers, they're not too impressive. And then when you break it down by home road split, it was something like 16 of his 23 home runs allowed had came in Arlington, despite a basically an equal amount of innings both on the road and at home. So I don't really know what to make of that. I will say that's probably a positive sign that he seems to be missing more bats than he did last year when his strikeout rate just cratered. I don't know if he's going to be an above average starter heading forward. I can buy that he's probably going to be maybe a mid rotation guy, and that's a huge upgrade for them. But it's just an interesting deal. And, frankly, I don't think they gave up a whole lot here. I don't know if you have a kinder take on Eddie Butler or the pitching prospect, but I'll note that MLB.com did not have Lacy in the Cubs top 30, and that's not a particularly strong or deep system anymore. So he seems, more like blast, I guess you would say here. And I don't know that Eddie Butler is so important to the Cubs or to any team that, he's headlining a deal that you actually regret or, a pair of prospects that you actually miss. So I like the deal for the Cubs. I'm just not sure what we're going to get from Hamels heading forward, if he'll be above average or just okay for them. Either way, though, he is an upgrade.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question there. The deal from the Rangers' perspective, I definitely agree with you. I don't think Butler's kind of like a flyer where he can be an arm that'll swing between the rotation and the bullpen for a team that desperately needs pitchers that exist. Lacey, I don't see as much of anything other than a flyer. The player to be named later, who knows? But to me, it really seemed like it was the $5 million that they get to save on Hamels' salary that was the real impetus for the Rangers to make this move, which, it kind of makes sense, but it's kind of sad because I really thought the Rangers were going to be a team that was in strong contention when they traded for Hamels originally. And they just haven't gotten to where they wanted to go ever since that deal took place. So it's kind of a bummer, I think, in one regard there. But yeah, it's going to definitely be an upgrade for the Cubs. Baseball Prospectus's DRA metric is very down on Cole Hamels this year. Yeah, his ERA is up, but his DRA is 6.18, which makes him a well below replacement level pitcher by that metric. It's largely due to, in fact, I think, to his home runs, of which there have always been plenty over his career, but almost twice as many as he normally gives up this season. I'm going to be really interested to see how he's able to adapt to Chicago because it's not the easiest place, even for a left-handed pitcher, to kind of rein in those home runs. So I wonder if he, I don't know, maybe changes his approach a little bit, maybe decides to play on the corners a little bit, maybe some of the framing help from the Cubs catching crew will help out a little bit, but I don't know. Maybe he'll just feel more comfortable with a better defense behind him than what the Rangers had. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't really know either. I assume they're gonna mess with his pitch usage a little bit because that just seems like a very Cubs and Jim Hickey thing to do. And of course, Hickey has a great reputation, and just from talking to people who've worked with him, he seems like the real deal. So it'll be interesting to see what they do there. Maybe have him throw his cutter more or something. I don't know. He's a veteran guy. He seems like a fairly intelligent guy, and I'm sure he'll pick up some tricks either from pitching staff like John Lester and company, Kyle Hendricks, or the coaching staff or the front office, and I think they'll find a way to help him maximize his performance. I'm just not sure, where that's going to leave him in terms of, a number two, a number four, somewhere in between there. So it'll be interesting to watch. But again, both of these deals are, pretty likable for the teams. I know we didn't really address what the Brewers gave up, but they dealt from depth. Jorge Lopez is a guy I liked. Realistically, if he couldn't cut the rotation right now, when is he ever going to break that rotation? And their bullpen is so loaded that I can understand trading a guy who's, kind of on the bubble there. And then Brett Phillips, again, a guy who has talent, good addition for the Royals, but at the same time, I don't think he was ever going to break that Brewers outfield. So deal from depth, even though you gave up two big league ready or about big league ready contributors, you're probably not going to miss them. And so that's, it's a nice thing to do for these guys because they deserve to get big league shots somewhere. And, certainly if they blossom for Kansas City, that's a win-win for both sides.
Yeah, I don't know if it kind of stuck out to you the way it did to me, but when I heard that Brett Phillips was going back to the Royals, he seems like a super Royalsy player. And I never really thought about it until the trade happened. But like, having some real tools in the outfield, but not necessarily the same level of performance to back up the tools. A guy who seemed like he was always had a little bit of hype, but never really got a chance to play off it. It just seemed very much to me like this is a very good fit between the team and the player. And I kind of think that we'll see him play in either a third or a fourth outfield role for the Royals for like 3 or 4 years, and he'll be just fine in that kind of position.
Yeah, I also like the deal Kansas City made recently to get Brian Goodwin. And he wasn't exactly like Phillips because he's a little older and, didn't necessarily have the same prospect shine later in his development arc. But Kansas City's outfield was a mess, and I like them taking chances on these post-hype sleeper types. Phillips, you can add Jorge Soler to this to this conversation. He kind of fits in too. Yeah, I mean, why not? Because that farm system is awful and they need help. And if this is the way you can get that help, then by all means, because, Mike Moustakas is a good player, but he realistically was never going to spend more than a half season to a full season back in Kansas City before another team came calling. And it just strikes me as so weird that no one else stepped up and signed Moustakas this winter because he's coming off a very good season, and it wasn't like he was a total fluke. I mean, he wasn't going to hit 40 home runs again in all likelihood, but he's a good player. And it's just weird how that worked out. And I'm glad to see now that that's kind of been corrected and that he's on a contending team. And I hope that depending on how his option works out this winter, a contender actually hands him a multi-year deal, because I believe he's earned that.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And, there is some versatility there, perhaps. And I definitely think, yeah, his on-base percentage is going to always be kind of an issue. But, power plays. And now the Brewers lineup is really powerful. I think it's where people might honestly still be underselling how much power that Brewers lineup packs. I mean, there's almost not even a spot regularly for Ryan Braun, and, between Eric Thames and Kane, and it's kind of fun that he gets to go back and play with former teammate Lorenzo Kane. I never would have expected both those guys would end up on the Brewers after last offseason, but it's a weird it's a really interesting lineup, and I think there's going to be a lot of fun as we kind of chase down the end of the month, the end of the season.
Yeah, and I think it's a testament to the Brewers lineup and their depth, but a guy like Domingo Santana, who actually led that team in OPS plus last season, I mean, he's an afterthought now, and I'm kind of expecting him to be traded somewhere else, perhaps to get some pitching help, because he's been lost at the plate this year. But there's no real clear path for him rejoining this roster and getting playing time. And when you could say that about a guy who almost certainly belongs in a big league lineup, albeit maybe as a left fielder or a DH, that's a testament to how much depth you have and how much quality you have in your outfield and at first base and what have you. So this Brewers front office, man, they might not get the props they deserve because they're really good. I just wish they had been a little more aggressive in pursuing starting pitching, both during the winter and right now during this month.
It makes way too much sense to me to see the path between the Brewers going out and getting Zach Wheeler from the Mets and Santana being a part of that deal. That just seems like a very Mets deal and a very the kind of thing that the Brewers would do.
Oh, absolutely. And while we're talking about the Brewers and, other deals they may or may not make, we should mention that they also went out and traded for a reliever during the week. And that reliever is Joaquin Soria. Matt Trueblood actually had a PPP day of that deal, which detailed how Soria has really developed a very good slider. So it's kind of funny timing-wise. But what do you think about the Brewers adding Joaquin Soria to an already deep and good bullpen?
I mean, it's the old kind of saying that you can't have enough relief pitching. The Brewers are proving that that might not be true because they have like seven great relievers in this bullpen. It's very much like the Yankees from last year. Corey Knebel hasn't been that great this year, but Hader's been incredible, and Jeremy Jeffress is pitching better than I think anybody would have expected. Corbin Burnes has come up and been absolutely lights out in his couple of innings. And then they've still got guys like Matt Albers. They've still got Dan Jennings, who's been effective. They've got Taylor Williams, who's been effective. It's a legit bullpen. And Soria's been great this year. He's been sneaky great. BP was all over the timing on the Soria thing. Like you mentioned, Trueblood had that nice piece on Soria. And I was actually in my BP chat, and somebody asked me which closer they thought would be traded first. And I said it was Joaquin Soria. And then 30 minutes later, he was traded. So I feel really good about that, and I also feel really solid then about the other guy I mentioned was Kirby Yates. So we got a couple of days left before the Padres deal him, but I think it's great for the Brewers. They gave up, I would say not, they gave up an equivalent amount of talent in Cody Medeiros, but I definitely feel like that's one of the moves you have to make if you're a team like the Brewers, because like we talked about, they have no starting pitching, and with the guys that they have in the bullpen, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they get into the playoffs and they're running two, maybe three bullpen games in a seven-game series.
Yeah, and it's an interesting strategy because, in theory, you can see that working out for them, right? You can run out Burnes for 2 innings. You can run out Hader for 2 innings. You can, you mix and match these guys depending on matchups. And I don't know if it's my preferred strategy, but again, members of that front office were in Tampa Bay when Joe Maddon basically did that during an ALDS game against the Red Sox. And I think he pulled Hellickson after an inning or inning and a third or something. Went to the bullpen and they held him to like one run the rest of the way. And hey, it's not my preferred strategy. I'm not really into the opener as we've discussed before and all that because I think that it's more headache than it's worth during the regular season. But once you get to the postseason, it's a different animal. And we're seeing teams like the Yankees, the Brewers, Cleveland, they've assembled these bullpens where, in theory, they can kind of leverage that strength during, October when you have these days off and you have, these must-win games. And it's really interesting to see, but I'm going to be my stereotypical self here and say they should still go get a starting pitcher. And even if it's, you know, someone like, you know, James Shields, the best big game pitcher in the world, you should do that because, you know, why not? Why not if you're Milwaukee, you have this opportunity to make the postseason and to perhaps go deep in the postseason, given how wide open the National League kind of feels beyond Chicago. So, yeah, I think they should go get a starting pitcher, but this is a good team, and it seems like a good team. It's going to be a good team for the foreseeable future.
Well, that's just it. I think that the Brewers have been really smart. While they've dealt away high-quality prospects, I don't think they've really damaged their window of contention. When you trade away high-level prospects and you get back guys like Christian Yelich, you're not really shifting your window of contention considerably because this is a player who's younger and under team control for a long time. And I just think they've made a lot of really smart moves recently. And I see them, you know, being a real threat to that top of that National League Central for three more years after this. And I think that's fun. It's always nice to see one of the, what we would consider the mid-market or the smaller market teams, you know, competitive on a budget without tanking. I really don't feel like the Brewers ever went into full tank mode either, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, and let's shift gears to talk about another team with ties to Milwaukee, who is more competitive than I think a lot of us expected, and who went out there and made two smart deals, in my opinion, for relievers, and that's the Atlanta Braves. They acquired Johnny Venters from the Rays and Brad Brock from the Orioles in exchange for some international bonus slot pool money. And I like both of these deals, honestly. You know, Brock is the more impactful of the two. He's lost some velocity this season, and the ERA is ugly. However, he's still getting swings and misses. And I think there's potential that getting him away from, you know, the American League East and also that Orioles defense will help his numbers look better. I know the command has also wavered a little bit, but you're giving up basically nothing in order to get him. And
well, before you go on about that, the Braves aren't giving up basically nothing to get him. They're giving up literally nothing to get these two pitchers. And I think that's a bigger discussion. Let's finish talking about the players that they're receiving back, because I feel very strongly about the bonus pool money changing hands as well.
Uh-oh, we're going to have a soapbox. But, yes, let's just touch on Venters really quick. Great story. Great to see him go back to Atlanta. But he's also been effective this season. And he had one, quote-unquote, open where he wasn't so good. Otherwise, he's held lefties to like a sub-600 OPS. Mm-hmm. And his numbers have been very impressive. Granted, you know, there's injury risk there. And you're kind of looking at a small sample still, but if they use him as a left-hand specialist or, you know, a middle reliever type, that's an upgrade for them because their bullpen has been wild, hasn't always been as effective as you would like to see. So I like both of these additions, even if there's some risk there. I think there's a chance Brock's best pitching of the season lays ahead of him, and that's why you go out and make these deals. So, Ryan, take it away.
Well, I just want to say with Venters, I really like the fact that he's now going to be part of a playoff run in Atlanta. After, you know, he well documented, he was one of the best setup men in baseball for years with Atlanta, had the Tommy John surgery issues. I just think it's actually a very nice story that he's coming back to Atlanta and going to be part of another potential playoff run. I also assume that at some point, I believe what I said in 2013 is that his arm was going to shoot off his body like a rocket. And I'm sure you're right at some point. There's a serious injury risk here. It's a matter of months before Venters gets injured rather than years, I think, in his case, which is unfortunate, but it'll be really nice while it lasts. And I'm really pleased to see that not only he made it back to baseball, but he's actually pitching very well. So good on him, good on Brock to get into the playoff hunt, and I'm excited for both those guys. I also don't think the Braves should have been able to acquire either of them. The Braves traded international bonus pool money for both these players. And as I understand it, the Braves were prevented from spending that international bonus pool money because of the sanctions that were levied against them, the penalties for their misuse and bad acts in the international market that, you know, were tied to John Coppola's tenure as the general manager of this team. So to me, this comes across as kind of a weird thing that the Braves were punished by not being allowed to use this international bonus pool money, and then they went and used this international bonus pool money to, instead of sign international players, to acquire major league players. That seems like the circumvention of the spirit of the sanctions against them, And I'm really not in favor of that. I think that they found the front office was smart to find a loophole to get around the sanctions levied against them, but they added two really fairly good relievers, granted on short-term contracts, when this money was supposed to be something that was a penalty against them. So I don't think that this is right that they were able to do that. I'm really kind of frustrated that the league office would allow for a loophole like this to be opened.
So, two things. One, apparently, based on Jeff Passan's tweet, the restrictions against them levied by the league actually don't kick in until the next two international signing windows. So, apparently, they're not actually trading money that they could not use right now. They could use this money. But yeah, I honestly did not know that either because I remember when the penalties were handed down. I don't actually believe that that was specified based on what Passan and even Ben Badler have reported. But yeah, I was shocked that they were able to trade these things too, and it wasn't until Passan offered a clarification that it made some more sense to me. Otherwise, you're right. It seems like a ridiculous loophole that the league shouldn't allow. And number two, you mentioned that these guys are rentals, and that is definitely the case in Brock's situation. He's a free agent at year's end. But if I'm doing the math right, Venners actually will not qualify for free agency until after next season because the Rays held him down just long enough where he won't have 6 years of service time after this year. So you're talking about a guy who could conceivably, if his arm stays attached and nothing blows up in it, be part of your bullpen next year too, if you would like. So technically, they might have gotten a little bit more than a rental pitcher in Venner's case, assuming I'm doing the math right now. I did clear that with a front office guy, and he said that, yeah, it seemed like that was the case. But that's an interesting wrinkle to the deal, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right about Venners. He is third-year ARB eligible, so he's not going to be a free agent until 2019, which is wild. I had not thought that, since Venters has been in the majors since 2010 and he's what, 33 years old? I expected that he was a free agent after the season, but I think you're right. I think you've hit that nail on the head there. The Passan stuff is interesting. I'm surprised that the Braves would get a free, I don't know, I don't want to say a free year of being able to spend that international bonus pool money this season. That seems kind of odd that the sanctions would be slowed to that extent where it would be next year and the year after, as opposed to this coming year, that this would affect them. Also, I think it's, I don't know, it's kind of a little bit odd that the Braves are not going to spend the money, that they're trading away that money if they do have it for this year, because they're going to be so short in the international market for the next 2 years. I'm kind of surprised they wouldn't want to try to invest this season because they're going to have that block coming up on them. But again, they probably are much more interested in helping their immediate prospects with the major league team since they're surprisingly, kind of ahead of the game when it comes to winning the National League East.
Plus, they have a loaded farm system still, so they're probably just saying, you know what, we'd rather give up, the mystery prize money rather than, or lotto ticket money rather than give up some of these established prospects who could conceivably help us in the near future. And, whether you agree with that or not, hey, I don't know. And whether you agree with Major League Baseball's decision to kind of postpone their punishment. Again, that's beyond my pay grade, and I can't claim to have any great insight into how that worked out. I can, however, claim to understand why the Yankees went out there and got Zach Britton, another Orioles reliever, in exchange for three prospects. The ones of note are Dylan Tate and Cody Carroll. Ryan, what did you think about this deal?
I think it made sense on both levels. I think that the Orioles needed to move on from Britton. It wasn't going to be something where, again, we're in the rental market for players. Britton was not going to be the type of guy who hung on and the Orioles were going to re-sign at the end of the season. At the same time, he does not really look like the pitcher that he once was at all. He's always outperformed his DRA and his FIP and those kind of other, ancillary measures of performance, but he still doesn't look right. He's looked a little bit better in his couple of games with the Yankees, but he hasn't looked good. And so I'm a little surprised that the Orioles were able to pry away even a prospect the caliber of Dylan Tate, who's not a bad prospect. He's probably a top 150 guy at this point. But I do think it makes sense for the Yankees because I think they want to shore up, even though they've got a great bullpen, they want to add more depth to it. They don't have the most starting pitching depth either, so having a lot of relievers is good for them. The deal makes sense both sides. I'm not sure this is going to be quite as impactful of a trade for the Yankees as people might believe it to be based on the name value of Zach Britton.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I have one thing to say about Britton, and then I want to address the prospects the Orioles got in return, and that's that I don't know that any pitching metric we have actually can appreciate the ground ball tendencies that Britton has displayed throughout his career, because we're talking about an extreme ground ball pitcher. You look at his career numbers on BP, and his ground ball rate is 66%. He had a few seasons where he was over 80%, and I just don't know that any metric can take into account how great that is and how dominant that is. So I guess I have reason to believe he's probably actually been better than WAR suggests he has, because WAR has him as below replacement level for his career, and that just feels wrong to me. But at any rate, let's talk about the return the Orioles received here. I think it's fine. Dylan Tate is interesting. He could become a mid-rotation starter. There's also a chance he's just a reliever, and I don't know which is more likely. I have not seen him. Certainly, he's not necessarily lived up to the hype that comes with being a number four pick in the draft, and then the Rangers traded him pretty quickly for Carlos Beltran as a rental player. So that raises eyebrows. But yeah, that's an interesting lottery ticket for the Orioles, and I'm a little worried because the Orioles have not shown the best pitching development
No.
patterns perhaps, but I hope it works out because that'd be a fun story. And with Cody Carroll, I could kind of see him developing into Drew Steckenrider, within the next year or so. You look at his minor league numbers for his career, he struck out 10 batters per nine, and he's walked four per nine, and he's allowed, and get this is right from his BRAF page, I'm not making this up, in 228 career innings, he's allowed eight home runs. That is 0.3 home runs per nine. That is insane. He has not allowed a home run in 43 AAA innings this season. He has not allowed a home run in his AAA career. That is insane to me. And yeah, the command issues are there, but he's got a near elite fastball, and he has an above average breaking ball. That's a very interesting profile, and I'm kind of excited to see him. I presume that he'll be up in the majors before the year is out. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing him. I don't think he's, going to turn into their closer or anything, but very interesting profile. And it's interesting to me that New York would give up on him when you could kind of see him being sort of like a right-handed Zach Britton proxy right now, maybe even a little better, depending on what you think about Britton. And his chances of continuing to regain his command and continuing to improve the effectiveness of a sinker. So it's interesting to me because New York is so good at pitching development and identifying these guys who have a little chicken left on the bone or who can do this or that and get a little bit better. But it's interesting to me they would give up a guy who seems big league ready or close to it for another reliever. So,
I think part of the thing with the Yankees is that because they are so good with pitching development, they kind of end up having a logjam a lot of times. I mean, that's why you always hear about people picking off Yankees pitchers in the Rule 5 draft because they have some serious 40-man issues trying to keep all these guys, in the organization that they're able to develop into, what could eventually be decent mid rotation or mid bullpen or, late inning guys. So I think that plays into it a little bit as well.
yeah, this is not the first time that the Orioles have went to the Yankee system to, get an arm. I believe they took one dude from their system in the Rule 5, and in the past they traded some international slot money for, I believe it was Jeffrey Rodriguez, right? Or Jeffrey Rodriguez. And I've only seen a little bit of him. Jeffy Ramirez, excuse me. I believe it's actually pronounced Jeffrey, so I'm messing his name up completely. Apologies to Mr. Ramirez. But I watched a little bit of him, and he looked kind of interesting. He looked like a guy who could maybe slot in as a back-end starter or at least be an interesting reliever. So I guess if you're needing pitching, you can do worse things and take whoever the Yankees are not protecting because they seem to have a lot of arms who are big league caliber.
I definitely agree with that. So let's talk a little bit about there are two relievers that were acquired by American League West teams that I think have a chance of actually making a difference in the playoff runs. And those are the Athletics went out and picked up the Mets' former closer, Jeurys Familia. And the Astros went out and picked up one of the quiet kind of breakout guys, I think, from this past year in relief, which is Ryan Pressly of the Minnesota Twins. If you had your choice for the rest of the season, which of those two guys would you rather have in your bullpen, Familia or Pressly?
Well, as far as I know, Presley has never had domestic violence allegations or charges brought against him. So probably that guy, because I know that's a non-baseball discussion there, but it's kind of hard to stomach.
Yes, for sure.
Anyway, that's more important than baseball. At the same time, if we're talking about the baseball aspects, I think Presley is also more interesting because he's a breakout guy, and there's been a lot of ink written about him. A lot of ink spilled about him recently, and he seems like a pretty interesting guy. And in addition to the talent aspects here, you're also talking about a guy who's under control for an additional season. And yeah, I think I would go with Presley. What about you?
Yeah, I definitely think Presley's slider I would take over Familia's sinker at this point. There's a huge difference in returns for these two guys. I mean, like you said, Presley has some control. Familia really doesn't. Presley has a history with no significant bad accident. Familia's got the domestic violence suspension. He's got a PED suspension. He's had a blood clot in his shoulder. So there's definitely, I think, a lot more warning flags, which, they're the Athletics. The Athletics are willing to accept those sometimes. But Presley is going to be more of a long-term fit for the Astros, probably. I do think for the rest of the season, there's not a huge difference between these guys. Yes, Presley's been excellent this year, way better than Familia from a DRA and from even a little bit from an FIP standpoint. He's striking out a ton of guys. But Familia's strength is a lot of it is his playoff experience, which hasn't always been good, but it exists, and his ability to get ground ball outs, which Presley doesn't do the same clip that Familia does. So I think both of them have a lot of value to the back end of a bullpen. But I'm really interested in the fact that the Athletics gave up very little in terms of prospect capital to get Familia, whereas the Astros had to give up two probably top 15 prospects from a pretty deep farm system in order to get Presley on their roster. So I don't want to say I like it from the Athletics perspective because they didn't have to give up much talent in order to obtain their pitcher, because it kind of feels dirty to say that about acquiring a guy with domestic violence in his background, who's, kind of a guy like Familia. But from a immediate value perspective, I definitely see why they did it. I just wish that there were less assholes in the game like Juris Familia that we'd have to talk about that as opposed to their on-field performance.
Right, and I guess, yeah. I mean, I don't really have much to add to that. It's awful. And I was gonna say, I guess I would ask, how much of this do you think is just the Mets valuing a different kind of skill set than other teams? Because we've seen that with their drafts and some of their other deals. But I guess the unfortunate thing there is that it leads me to say, with the Aroldis Chapman deal in the past, we're probably gonna see Roberto Osuna get traded for more than you'd like to see any team value him at this point, which is to say value him at all. I don't know. I don't know how much of this is the league, actually having a conscience and a soul, and how much of it is just, oh, the Mets may have not negotiated well or may have wanted to dump Familia and his financial commitments sooner than they otherwise would have if they had waited it out and tried to get a better deal. So it's a little disheartening that we have to have, that conversation, and that we actually have to think about those sort of things, because, that's really, kind of outlines the baseball as a business, and it doesn't have much of a heart when you get right down to it.
I'll just point this out really quickly. I think that the Twins got two really nice pieces back in exchange for Presley. They've got in Jorge Alcala, they've got a guy who's got a legitimate chance to start in a major league rotation, which is weird to say about the Twins. I'm still in shock from, 10 years of terrible starting pitching. And Gilberto Celestino, the outfielder that they got in the deal, I researched both these guys as part of my baseball prospectus annual prep last year when I wrote up the Astros. Celestino's got some real talent, especially for a guy who's not yet 20 years old. And he just got bumped up to Corpus Christi, Double A, for the Astros off the strength of a very nice showing in Low A this year. I don't know where he's going to fit in necessarily in the Minnesota system. I don't know if they're going to put him in High A, if they're going to leave him in Double A. But this is the type of guy who could emerge in a couple of years as a legitimate everyday outfielder. He's got the tools and he's got the skills to be able to do it. And he's performed, granted, at the lower levels, but in every level he's been at, really, in the Astros minor league system. So he's a little bit of a ways off, but he could be a legitimate, you know, foundational player for this Twins team. So I think they did a really nice job turning an asset into some decent long-term potential.
And I want to note here, because, you know, I've been a critic in the past of the Astros and how they approach the rebuild, and, you know, certainly their ownership group with Jim Crane's past allegations that are very serious and I think probably don't receive enough attention. Even among MLB owners, they seem very serious. And I want to give them credit for being willing to trade prospects, because they have not been a team who's forwarded prospects, and, you know, they haven't necessarily done the whole, you know, efficiency thing where, oh, you know, we're never going to trade for players who are perceived as rentals. We're not going to trade for players on big contracts and all that stuff. You know, they have been willing to do that. And so I give them credit for that, because they could have easily, you know, stood pat and maybe not maximized their chances of winning by, you know, just hoarding these guys. So good for them for actually, you know, being willing to trade prospects and, you know, not hoard the talent and not, you know, kind of take advantage of what had been a chilly market, not only in terms of trades, but also free agency. And, you know, it seemed like we were at a point where it was going to be easier for these super teams to stay super teams, because there wasn't much talent required to go out there and get a player for half a season or a season and a half or whatever. So it's actually kind of refreshing to see the Astros being willing to trade these prospects, even if it might come back to bite them in a few years.
Yeah, although to be fair, you look at the trades that they've made for Justin Verlander, and it's like, nope, that looks pretty good. And you look at the trade yes. they made for Gerrit Cole, and they're like, nope, that looks pretty good. So,
no, that's a fair point. But it was interesting to me that you introduced those pair of trades by saying that these guys could potentially impact the American League West race or the American League playoff race, because there was another American League team who is right there in the thick of things who also traded for a reliever that I think we could throw into that conversation, and that's the Mariners. They went out there and took advantage of the Cardinals' bloodletting of their bullpen by acquiring Sam Tuivasa from, again, the Cardinals, in exchange for, I believe it was a minor league pitcher named Seth Elledge. And, you know, Tui is kind of interesting to me. He's a converted backstop. He throws very hard, and in about 98 big league innings, he has a 113 ERA+. He has a 2.32 strikeout to walk ratio. Command hasn't always been his friend. However, you're talking about a guy who, again, has multiple years of control remaining. He won't actually qualify for free agency until after the 2022 season, which, frankly, with middle relievers and how their lifespans tend to work, he may never reach that point. So, in the interim, though, he has a chance to be, I think, an average to above average middle reliever for the Mariners. Do you agree?
I don't know about the above average part. That's kind of the reason why I didn't lump him into the same category as we had with the other two guys, is that I kind of think Tui is going to be a guy who is a nice piece to have. He's been pitching very well for the Cardinals, so I don't want to diminish that. But he doesn't seem like the type of guy who's going to slot into the back end of a bullpen at any point, I think. His stuff just doesn't pop the same way. He has made some gains in terms of his swing strike rate and things like that going forward the last couple of years, but he still is about a 7 or 8 strikeout per nine guy. The control and the command are fine, but they don't jump out at you. The real value in him is the fact that he's not even going to be ARB eligible for another year or so. I think he becomes ARB eligible after 2019. Which makes him a very valuable component to a Mariners team that's always like butting up against the upper edges of a payroll cap, whatever the team is kind of deciding to spend. So I think he's going to be very useful, as he's going to kind of be one of those guys that you can set and forget in the middle of the bullpen, and you don't have to worry about, you know, at least the sixth inning is under control kind of thing. But I just, I'm not sure he really moves the needle for the Mariners at this point.
Yeah, and Elledge, let's just touch on him really quickly, mm-hmm. was actually a 2017 draft pick of the Mariners, and he was ranked in the system's top 10 according to MLB.com. Now, the Mariners have like the worst farm system in baseball. So when we say he was ranked in their top 10, what we really mean is he has a pulse and some big league hope. And it's just interesting to me that DePoto continues to trade from his farm system, and I don't know how they're going to refresh that farm system. And that would seem very important to this team's short-term and long-term success because they do seem capped out. They don't seem to have a way to acquire talent otherwise, and I just don't know how that's going to play out over the next few years as that core, which is already kind of old, continues to age. And if they miss out on the playoffs this season, I think they might actually have some remorse from extending DePoto and extending the contract of their manager and some of the other coaches or whatever there, because this team doesn't seem like it's built for success beyond the season. And I know that things can happen, and it's certainly better to be bold and to be proactive than tank or rebuild unnecessarily. But boy, I don't know how that team's going to survive after this year. Do you?
YOLO, YOLO. I don't think
Yeah.
that the Mariners are really considering the long term, and I'm fine with it. It reminds me a lot of what's happened with the Detroit Tigers, and you see what position they're in now. The Tigers spent a lot; they had a very old, aging roster, and then there was just this full collapse, basically. And once they collapsed, it's going to be a long haul to get back to contention. At the same time, I don't think a lot of teams would trade that. There's a big difference between going all in and trying to compete and extending your window as long as possible, and then having to suffer from that later on, rather than tanking. And I think that's kind of the position that the Phillies took a few years ago. I think it's the position that the Tigers took and are suffering from recently. And I truly believe that the Mariners are going to be in much the same situation the next year or two. I would much rather see teams do what the Mariners are doing, even if it puts the future at risk, than the teams that are tanking because they think that they can do it to improve the team and they don't care about winning today. I would much rather see teams care about winning today rather than, if the Mariners didn't make some of these moves, they would probably be a bad team with the chance of being average as opposed to being a good team with the chance of being very, very bad.
That makes sense. And I want to shift to another team who acquired a pair of relievers over the last few days. That'd be the Colorado Rockies, who are trying to maximize their playoff potential. They went out there and got Santiago Casilla from, well, I believe he'd been designated for assignment by the A's. And they also traded for San Juan Oh from the Blue Jays, because the Blue Jays are seemingly just accepting a place in the void, I guess, the competitive void. And of the two, I think we can agree that O is probably more impactful here. And 48 innings a season, including an inning with the Rockies, is a 1.64 ERA plus, 5 strikeouts per walk. He was someone who, over the winter, we had originally talked about him signing with the Rangers. I guess there was some medical issue there that prevented that. But I think the point we had made is that if the baseballs were tweaked with again, he could actually find himself as a productive late inning reliever again. And sure enough, it seems like the deadening of the baseballs or whatever they did there has helped him, because his home run rate has dropped from 1.5 per nine back to 0.9 per nine. He's always throwing strikes. He's always kind of lacked the power stuff you're accustomed to seeing from late inning relievers, but he's an effective, versatile guy, and I like that addition for the Rockies, who spent a ton of money during the winter. Adding Wade Davis and retaining Jake McGee and adding Brian Shaw, and yet have had a horrible bullpen this year that really could use a couple of steady hands. So the O addition, pretty good in my book. Casilla, I don't really know what they're going to get from him. He's got a pretty ERA this year, but he's walked 6 for 9, and he's not a guy who usually walks that many. So I'm kind of curious as to what's been going on there, because I haven't really kept close tabs on him. Have you?
I've been watching him a little bit. He hasn't looked good this year. The Rockies haven't even put him on the major league roster. They're going to send him to AAA to start, which, I think is indicative of the fact that he's just not really much of anything at this point in his career. And if he can find something to bring him back to that level that he was at for a little while in San Francisco, all the better, but I just don't have any real faith that he's going to be an important part of a Rockies bullpen, which right now looks very strong, I think. I know they've had some ups and downs already this season with guys like Sean McGee not really starting off up to their expected performance. But now Adam Ottavino is looking like possibly the best reliever in baseball. They've still got Wade Davis. I think they've got a very, very strong bullpen. I'm still not a believer in the Rockies making it to the playoffs. I just don't see them getting one of those wild card spots because I think the competition is too stiff. If I were them, I would seriously consider trying to make another move to improve the rotation. Though their guys have been pitching very well recently. I mean, Anderson, Freeland, and Senzatella have all been pitching very well recently. It just seems like they have too large of a collection of good but not great players, so it's even hard for them to make a substantial improvement in a lot of areas. But I just I think that this team is a little bit outmatched by some of the other teams in the National League. I think, you know, whatever the Cubs or Brewers who don't win the Central are going to take a wild card spot. And I still think the Diamondbacks have a better team on paper than the Rockies do. So I'm a little nervous about their ability to squeak by and make it into the playoffs.
I agree with all that. And we should probably touch on the return for the Blue Jays got a first baseman named Chad Spanberger. He was a sixth-round pick in the 2017 draft. And so far this year, he's pretty much mashed an A-ball, but that's Asheville for you. And who knows? I'm pretty much a proponent of trading your college first baseman who are mashing an A-ball whenever you can. And then the other guy they traded was Forrest Wall, who you might recall from the 2014 draft. I believe it was a supplemental first-round pick. He actually performed pretty well in high A this season, although that's a California league for you, and he has subsequently cratered in double A, and who knows what the future holds for him. But I don't really have issue with the Rockies giving up either of these guys to fuel their pursuits.
No, neither do I. Let's talk a little bit about that team that we just talked about, hanging out a little bit above them in the National League West, the Diamondbacks. There was a lot of movement these last few days, this last week, really, player movement. And the Diamondbacks made two trades, and I really like both of them, and I think it's worth talking about them because they kind of flew under the radar, I think. They did two moves. They acquired Eduardo Escobar, the shortstop utility infielder combo player from the Minnesota Twins, in exchange for Joan Duran, Ernie De La Trinidad, and Gabriel Maciel. And then they also picked up swingman Matt Andrees from the Rays for Michael Perez and Brian Schaefer. I really like both of these moves for the Diamondbacks, and I think that they dramatically improve positions of need for this Diamondbacks team. How do you feel about them?
No, I like both as well. Now, I was not around when the Escobar deal went down, so I don't know as much about the prospects as you probably do. However, you know, Escobar is a really interesting player to me, and it makes a lot of sense for them to go out and get a guy like Escobar because of the fact that, you know, their middle infield hasn't really performed as they would have hoped, and I know Chris Owings hasn't really had the season they would like him to have, so, you know, some unsettled business, you know, on the middle infield. So adding a guy like Escobar who can conceivably slot in at second or at short or even at third if need be, you know, he provides more offensive potential than anyone they had, and you know, it's a rental, and yeah, I have no issue with that. I think that's a smart move, and it wouldn't surprise me if we look back and say, you know, that was one of the smarter moves at the deadline, because I do think this Arizona team has a chance to, you know, claim a wild card spot, so no issues there. With the Andrees deal, you know, I don't understand what the Rays were doing with Matt Andrees all year long.
Nope.
And I knew that other teams were interested in him and had kind of been rebuffed along the way, and that surprised me, because it didn't seem like the Rays valued him a ton, and I was, you know, kind of surprised that they traded him, and I was also surprised that, you know, what they got back, because I don't know, I just, you know, Andrees seems to me like a guy you could conceivably bring to camp next year as a back-end starter, which, you know, the Diamondbacks don't necessarily have a ton of rotation depth, so maybe you do that. He's also a guy who can conceivably help you in a multi-inning relief role right now. And, you know, you remember last year they kind of used Archie Bradley as a rover. And Andrés is not on that level, but it would be interesting to me if they kind of use Andrés and kind of a hybrid role, and maybe have him work two or three innings here and there as a bridge guy or something. And I think he's about an average, maybe a little bit below that as a starter, but I think he's potentially a number four slash number five as a starter and a fine middle reliever. And he's seen his strikeout rate tick up this season, and he was never a guy who really was expected to have a high strikeout rate, so that's interesting. And he has flaws, let's not pin over that, but yeah, he seems like a useful arm to add. And for what they gave up, a guy who couldn't crack their catching depth chart, who was available in last year's Rule 5 draft and as a minor league free agent. And I'm talking about Michael Perez here. I know he has good framing numbers, but geez, even if he becomes a backup catcher, I think that's a solid deal. And then Schaefer, based on the scouts I've talked to, he doesn't seem to be. Let's put it this way: if he turns into Matt Andrés, the Rays got a great, great, great return, because that doesn't seem likely at all. So, yeah, I don't have an issue with either of these deals.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Escobar is he very quietly is having an outstanding season at the plate. He's got a 292 true average. He's got a 338 on base percentage, but he's slugging like crazy. He's one of those guys who has really improved his power over the last couple of years with Minnesota. He's not a young guy. He's 29. This is age 29 season, but he's already hit 15 homers on the season. And like you said, the middle infielders in Arizona really haven't done what the team kind of hoped they would. I think that Ketel Marte has been fine at times, but now he's injured. It just is. It was a weird kind of setup that this team had, generally speaking. But now Jake Lamb is going to the disabled list, and I think that this deal was in place before Lamb's injury. So I think that they were always kind of planning on having Escobar fill in the middle, whether it's for Descalzo, for Ahmed. But Escobar's a good defensive player. He can play anywhere on the left side of the infield. But now he's going to take a kind of a more leading role, I think, in the middle of this Diamondbacks lineup, and he can kind of hold up there. He's been really good. He's been on a tear so far the last couple of weeks with Minnesota. And I really think he's an underrated player who, deserves a little bit more limelight, which, you're not going to get playing for Arizona, but okay, whatever. And with Andrés, I really like him as a 2 to 3 inning reliever. Dare I say it, in an opener. He kind of pitches like an he kind of pitches like an opener even when he's scheduled to start, because things start to get dicey in like the fourth inning. But I really like Andrés as a guy who you can use as, I don't want to say the Josh Hader role, because that implies a racism to your pitching performance, but you can use him in that kind of 2 inning, 3 inning relief role, and I think he'd be pretty effective in it. I wouldn't necessarily want to try to shoehorn him into a starting rotation at this point, but with the Diamondbacks, they don't need to do that. They've got enough starting pitching. So I really like him as an addition to the bullpen. And what you said before, I don't really think the Diamondbacks gave up too much in terms of their depth and prospects. I mean, none of these guys that they gave up as part of the Escobar deal cracked their top 10 in terms of I think it's the MLB.com org rankings. Maceo was like the 11th best prospect in the system. Duran was like the 19th. These are not guys that are, can't miss prospects. They're all kind of flyer class A guys. And when you're the Diamondbacks and you really need to try to make it back into the playoffs and maybe get past the first round this time, I think it's a good investment to make. I'm really all for both these trades.
Yeah, and Perez, to be clear, he's in AAA, but again, he cannot crack a depth chart that has Alex Avila struggling, Jeff Mathis struggling, and John Ryan Murphy also struggling. Like, I don't know, man. I get the framing, but if the Diamondbacks front office, who seemingly is solid, I would say they might be an underrated front office based on their work so far. If they aren't even convinced this guy is, big league caliber to the extent that they try him over a trio that really has not performed all year long, what are you really getting there? So I don't know. I'm very, very curious to see how that one works out, but I agree. These seem like pretty solid deals on paper for the Diamondbacks, and it seems like they're gonna probably grab one of those wild card spots, and that's a fun team if they can get going, because it seems like a lot of their lineup Clogs have just not performed this year. You know, they went out there and got Souza during the winter. He hasn't performed.
No.
Lamb hasn't performed. Owings, I mentioned earlier, has not performed. John Jay hasn't performed. Gerard Dyson hasn't performed. Basically, none of their hitters have hit outside of Goldschmidt,
Well,
Peralta, and AJ Pollock, and Descalzo of all people.
yeah, Descalzo's been pretty good all season, which makes no sense, and I don't understand. The thing about the Diamondbacks is, like you said, they've had guys who have had down seasons. It's one of those teams where nobody has been healthy and or performing at the same time. Like, this isn't a team that's gotten like together with their performances. And I think if they do at some point, you know, if Goldschmidt keeps hitting the way he has, but now Pollock really starts rolling with him, Peralta starts getting in a groove, and then the starting pitching, if they kind of settle back into, you know, Greinke's been very consistent, Corbin's been very good this year, but Robbie Ray hasn't always been healthy, and Clay Buchholz is still, an enigma in some ways. Shelby Miller is maybe going to get healthy, maybe not. It's just one of those things where it's one of those teams, if you see them at the end of September and everything's running smoothly, be very, very afraid going into the playoffs.
Yeah, and you know if they catch fire, they have a chance to actually perhaps find themselves in the NLCS game. But you know the odds of the NLCS game, the NLCS series. Well, that's repetitive. Whatever. You know what? It's time to move on, and
Let's talk about the Rays some more. I really want
oh
to get
no.
your opinion on this deal. The Red Sox picked up Nate Eovaldi from the Rays in exchange for Jalen Beeks. The Rays no longer have any starting pitchers. They've got Chris Archer and Yonny Chirinos as the only starting pitchers in their rotation. I'm all for doing new and cool and fun stuff, but there are also rumors that Archer could be on his way out of Tampa. What are the Rays doing? I get that you trade Nate Eovaldi because he's not a long-term fixture for this team. He's kind of the very idea of a rental, but you have to have somebody starting most of your games because you can't just run bullpen games every other day, can you?
I just want to note one other thing before I address that, and that their handling of Yonny Chirinos has not received any attention nationally,
It's
but it
bad.
is, it's honestly appalling because Chirinos was pretty effective early on as a, you know, starting pitcher slash opener hybrid. He got hurt, they sent him on rehab, and then they kept him down there for an absurd amount of time, given that, you know, he had performed and that he was seemingly healthy and that you know, there was no reason for them to keep him down as long, and I don't know what the explanation is. And frankly, it looks so bad. It looks like they were just manipulating his service time because they could. And yeah, I just want to point that out that I think that's ridiculous if that's what they did, and it's unacceptable if that's what they were doing. But with regard to the trade, you know, getting Jalen Beeks back, it reminds me a little bit of when they got Andrew Moor from the Mariners and you know, some of these other moves they've done where they're basically monopolizing these fringe guys who most teams don't necessarily view as starting pitchers and who aren't viewed as elite. Okay, you laughed at that, but you know I'm right. And also aren't viewed as like elite reliever prospects. They're those bubble guys who are going to bounce around to eight different teams before either, you know, being banished for good or slotting in as, I guess, a long man or whatever. And in Beek's case, I believe the MLB scouting report, the MLB.com scouting report, had him with a 45 fastball and 45 command. And look, I don't know how many pitchers out there with that profile actually ever produce much, right? Because if you don't have a good fastball, you need command. And if you don't have good command, you need a good fastball. Well, this guy doesn't seem to have either. And when you watch his delivery, it's very, how do I put this, stiff, and it doesn't seem like a good command profile, so it's hard to really see him gaining in that regard. And I know his fastball has some rise on it, but if you look at the numbers, they're not necessarily elite. I believe Brooks has him around like 9.5 inches of vertical movement, not in the danger zone, but you know, it's also not elite. So I'm kind of curious. I know his off-speed pitches are supposed to be better, and you know, he's left-handed, so who knows? And yeah, certainly his Triple-A statistics were good. He ranks like sixth in the Red Sox system, although that's not really the praise that it used to be. And he also got torched in his first outing with the Rays, which is against the Orioles in 3 1/3 innings, 10 hits, 8 runs all earned, 3 walks, and a strikeout. He walked Tim Beckham twice. And, you know, I'm a Tim Beckham fan, but if you're walking him twice in a game, you're not having a good outing. So I don't know, man. I don't know. They're, like I said, they're monopolizing acquiring these 45 types who, I don't know that building your roster, either your 25 or 40 man roster out of fringe pitchers is smart. I don't think this is going to work. If it works, I'm not sure it deserves to work because it just seems like you're painting yourself into a corner. And I think I made this point before on here. When you do this opener strategy and you do this, roster shuffle between St. Pete and Durham, you necessarily have to change the kind of players you acquire and that you staff your roster with. And what I mean by that is you have to have players who have options. And players who have options, almost by definition, are either younger or they're the kind of older players who aren't good enough to, maintain a spot in the major leagues, like the Wilmer Fonts, and the Vidal Nunoz and these other types who they've been around, but they haven't been good enough to consistently stay on a 40-man roster to burn their options. Like you basically take yourself out of the running for any good free agent reliever or any reliever who would be worth trading for. And I don't know if that's really smart because it seems like you're basically eschewing talent in order to go for, how do I put this kindly? Just, guys who really fit into the whole paperwork hustle aspect. You know what I mean? Like they're basically preferring flexibility contractually over talent. And I just don't think that's a good way to go about building a competitive team.
Yeah, it's a mystery to me. Like I can understand wanting to do the opener thing, and I can understand wanting to supplement when you already have a bunch of issues in your rotation. You can't really complain too much about the injuries to guys like Faria and Snell, who were very, very good when they were able to pitch. Faria had a little bit of a down season this year before his injury, but he's been injured for so much of the season, it doesn't really matter. So that part of it, you gotta kind of build up your depth when Honeywell and Faria, those guys get injured. But I agree with you. I think it's very strange that the players they seem to be targeting all seem to fit that mold that you talk about. They work so hard to keep service time down. In the case of Chirinos, it's ridiculous. He never should have gotten 8 starts in Durham. That makes no sense when they're throwing just absolute garbage at the major league level. I kind of want to see Chris Archer go, but I also worry that if the Rays trade Chris Archer before the deadline, we're going to see something really ugly in terms of guys in this Rays bullpen throwing like 4 innings in back-to-back games and like really strange stuff that's going to, I don't think it's bad for baseball, but it could be very bad for the pitchers themselves, and it could be very embarrassing for the teams that they play against when they're putting up 12 runs because Jamie Schultz has to pitch, back-to-back games where he throws 50 innings. I mean 50 pitches. So it's disappointing. I really think that if the Rays had kept healthy, that we may not be seeing this kind of disaster of a pitching staff, but I don't know, maybe we would have anyway.
No, I think we would have anyway, because this is something they had tinkered with in the past, and it was clearly something they had in mind. And look, they have an impressive amount of young talent on that farm system, and there's a chance that this all works out and they're competitive beginning next year. I mean, they've certainly, I had them for 79 wins. I believe they're currently at 500. So, yeah, they're outplaying my expectations, and kudos to them for that. Kudos to Kevin Cash for finding a way to, guide this team that's seemingly patchwork, to what's right now a 500 record, and they've certainly been over 500 lately. So it was a winning team until recently. At the same time, if this team goes on to be competitive, I don't think the front office has earned it at all. They have consistently gotten horrible returns on their trades. They're doing things that, like you said, are endangering their pitchers' arms potentially. They're seemingly screwing over the future of this team to save money, and yet at the same time, they are trading anyone who makes money on their big league roster for, again, pennies on the return. So this is a team that is basically just so averse to spending money that I don't know how you can actually project them to keep guys like Willy Adames and Jake Bowers and any of these other talented youngsters they'll bring up beyond maybe 3 or 4 seasons. Because once they hit arbitration, if they're this averse to spending any money, what makes you think they're going to keep anyone? You know, they're shopping around Archer, and it seems like that's serious. You know, the talks are serious. Well, you know, he's on a very nice contract. We can talk about how his performance hasn't been ace-like in recent seasons, and that's certainly a good conversation to have, but where does it stop? You know, are they, after they dump Archer, are they going to go out there and try to move Kevin Kiermaier? I know he's had a very bad season at the plate. I frankly wouldn't have extended the guy, but, you know, he's the only other guy on this roster, I believe, who's making any money that's guaranteed over the next few seasons. Like, where does it stop with this team? And at what point do we just say that this is completely unacceptable? And this is not innovation. This is being cheap and trying to find the cheapest way to field a team that doesn't lose, you know, 100-plus games. And I don't think that's a goal we should – you know, why is that the goal? Why is that what we accept from this team when they have – that TV deal worth, what, $1 billion? I know it's backloaded, but come on. If they have a TV deal, they get like $50 million a year in revenue sharing. They got the $50 million from the Bantic sell. We can keep listing off things here, but why is it acceptable that this team is ran this way? And why do we cover it up by saying, oh, they're innovative, they're creative? Like, why do we accept this? Why is this okay?
Well, one thing that's interesting is if they had been aggressive leading into the deadline, you know, willing to spend some money, willing to take on some contracts, willing to trade from their long-term depth in the farm system, like you said, this is a 500 team. And the holes that this team has to fill are enormous ones where, you know, one or two moves can make a gigantic difference for a team like this. If you can stop it from being like, you know, a Joey Wendell, Carlos Gomez platoon in the outfield and replace that with like a suitably decent hitting outfielder, I don't know. Maybe there's a guy on the Pirates like Corey Dickerson that they could get who would be a fine hitting outfielder. Or maybe they could add a decent infielder or, I don't know, just another starting pitcher to kind of prop up their rotation like a Nate Eovaldi. You know, they could still be a competitive and good team, and especially if they wanted to be aggressive with their spending. Go out and get, you know, the Giants want to get out from Andrew McCutchen. Rent him for the rest of the season. And, right. You know, you can do all sorts of things to make this team continue to be competitive that aren't really going to hurt the long-term value of the team, but are going to cost a little bit of money. Yeah. And they're afraid to do that. They won't do that.
Yeah, and, you know, again, nothing against the prospects they have. Farm system's good. They're going to run into a situation here pretty soon where they're facing a roster crunch. And what I mean by that is they have a lot of guys who are going to be, you know, Rule 5 eligible, and they don't necessarily have the room to house all these 45, 50 OFP guys, right?
Yeah.
And yet their pitching strategy right now where they're having to roster all these Andrew Moores and Jalen Beeks and, you know, these other guys we mentioned who are kind of fringy guys, that works against protecting as many of those guys as possible. The Rays should really be taking their prospect depth, dealing it for guys who can help now, or at least, you know, finding three or four of these decent but not great prospects and getting a guy who's maybe a little bit of a better prospect. It's sort of what the Dodgers have done. You know, they have all that prospect depth. They take four or five of them. They go out there and they get a better player, and that helps manage the crunch that's coming because otherwise you're going to get picked apart in the World 5 draft and, you know, minor league free agency or what have you because you cannot protect everyone, and you're openly hurting your ability to protect as many as possible by building your pitching staff this way. So it doesn't seem like there's vision. It doesn't seem like there's foresight. It just seems like they want to save as much money as possible and that they're willing to just strip mine their big league roster and especially – their big league payroll in order to chase. I don't know what the end game is here. And again, nothing against the players, nothing against the fan base. I really wish that they would do a better job for that fan base. And, you know, it's just the front office does not deserve to win because I guess it's the ownership that doesn't deserve to win if they're, you know, mandating that they cut payroll and all. And I just don't understand. I don't understand why this is acceptable because it's pathetic. Is what it is. And if you're not willing to spend, you know, if $70 million is really your cap for payroll nowadays, given how much money is around the league, then you don't deserve to own the team. And if the team cannot sustain a payroll higher than that, then it doesn't deserve to exist.
So
bad situation, man.
Yeah, it is a bad situation. Let's transition a little bit to another team whose payroll seems to be disappointing for their fan base and another ownership group that takes a lot of heat, rightfully so. The New York Mets. They dealt infielder Asdrubal Cabrera to the Phillies for Franklin Colome. Cabrera has definitely been a guy who's been on the block for a while, as he's, a guy with an expiring contract who can hit and play a couple of different infield positions. This trade is a little bit different from most of the trades we've seen the Mets make recently, in that everybody doesn't hate it. The Mets have, for a long time, for the last 2 years, been trading away players in the attempt that they would get other teams to eat their whole salary and take back a return that is generally considered inferior to what might have brought back if the team would have eaten a little bit of salary. The Familia trade we talked about earlier, trades for Addison Reed and what was it? I think it was Jay Bruce. They tend to give up the contracts and accept less of a return for the pitchers. The Lucas Duda trade. There have been plenty of times over the last year where they've brought back guys who are kind of middle reliever prospects, not even guys who are projected to be end of the bullpen guys. But this time, it seems like the Mets finally got a talented prospect back for one of their rentals that they're trying to move away from, and that's Franklin Colome of the Philadelphia Phillies. I think that in this case, it might have more been accidentally that the team got a better prospect just because Cabrera is a pretty desirable commodity for a team like the Phillies, a guy who can really hit, switch hitter, play multiple positions, can move around. Basically, I think it's who the Phillies were hoping Scott Kingery would have been this season. But that didn't work out so well from a performance standpoint. Cabrera's a legit player who could maybe provide, a little bit less value than a Manny Machado over the rest of the season, but a very solid infielder. Colome is kind of like a fringe top 100 guy. Hasn't developed quite the way that the Phillies would have wanted him to, but still has the potential to start in the major leagues. If not, maybe could be an impact reliever. I'm happy with this trade from the Mets' perspective that they're finally getting back a quality prospect for one of their rentals, but how do you feel about this deal?
No, I think it makes a lot of sense on both sides. As you mentioned, the Phillies kind of had higher expectations for Kingery. That hasn't came to fruition, at least not yet. So getting a veteran, getting a guy like Cabrera, who, as you mentioned, switch hitter, above average hitter, not the best defender in the world, but whatever. You're going to live with that at this point, considering your alternatives. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And you're right, the Mets seemingly got a better return than they did in the Familia trade and some of the other trades they made over the years. So kudos to them. And yeah, I mean, this solid deal on both sides, I think. And the Phillies, their lineup looks pretty solid right now, doesn't it? I really like Cesar Hernandez. Obviously, Santana is an above average stick himself. I don't know what to make of Franco, but his overall numbers have been above average. And you have Hoskins, you have Herrera, you have Nick Williams has had a solid season. And I don't know if I buy into this team making the postseason, but we're at this point in the year where you cannot ignore this team. You can't ignore that. The pitching staff has made strides. Those young starters have gotten better, and I guess I gave Kapler an apology because, I didn't think he was necessarily going to last an entire season without being ran out of town. But to his credit, he has adapted and he's seemingly, talked with the players on his team and made adjustments that he needed to make. And kudos to him for that because it's very easy to become ossified once you hit a certain level of success or once you've, been around for a while. And, he came in with a lot of new ideas and he's, kept the ones that worked and gotten rid of the ones that didn't work. And that takes some courage and it takes some humility and kudos to him because those are not, the humility aspect is not necessarily something that people thought he had entering this gig. So I was wrong about him, it looks like. And yeah, good for them.
Well, some of it's the chicken and the egg problem. Like, how much of it is Gabe Kapler, really showing some leadership and causing the team to do well, and how much of it is the team's doing well? So it's kind of tough to screw it up, kind of that side of things, I feel like. I was very much for the Kapler signing. I'm more of a Kapler supporter, I think, than most. Because I really like his approach to player development. But at the same time, we talk about teams running on all cylinders. It seems like the Phillies are kind of running on all cylinders right now. They made some really, I think, smart moves this offseason in the Santana and Arrieta deals. They just look they look solid and they look young, and I'm very, very concerned about what they're going to do in free agency this offseason. Not from the Phillies' perspective, but from the rest of the league perspective, because they could very easily go out and be a big player for a guy like Machado or Harper,
Or both, potentially.
or both, which is that's truly terrifying. I don't know why you would do that to me. It's going really well in Philadelphia, which is really strange to say and to feel. But I'm with you. I like this deal. I think Cabrera is the type of player that you bring in, and even if you have to give up a prospect of Colomé's caliber to do it, I see this as a playoff team this year, and I never thought I would say that. Now, that means they'll have to knock off one or more of either the Braves atop the division or one of the wild card teams, whether it's the Diamondbacks or the Cubs or the Brewers or something like that. But they're playing like a playoff team right now, so kudos to them.
Yeah, and another team playing like a playoff team who traded for a veteran position player, the Houston Astros, and they dealt Patrick Sandoval to the Angels for backup catcher Martin Maldonado. Ryan McCann's dealing with some injury issues, so Maldonado might actually take on a bigger role in the interim period until he returns, and they do expect him to return. So it's just a matter of if, excuse me, when, not if. With Maldonado, I've liked him since he broke into the league. I used to talk about how much I enjoyed watching him and Willie Peralta work, which dates me and also shows that I have awful taste in ball players. But, Maldonado is kind of your stereotypical backup catcher in that he doesn't hit at all, but he's got a good glove. He actually won the Gold Glove Award last year, which people forget because why would you remember such a thing in the
Exactly.
year 2018? But above average framer, strong arm. He used to give haircuts in the clubhouse, and he's earned the nickname El Machete, I think, which is a great nickname for a backup catcher. But yeah, he's a free agent after the season. Yeah, that's a, that'll work, right? That's
Yeah.
work.
Yeah, he's fine, and as a backup to your backup catcher, the new Max Stassi, while Stassi's in the lineup, this is absolutely fine. They gave up very little value to get him. Evan Gattis really isn't much of a backup catcher at all at this point. I think the less said about him being behind the plate, the better. It's surprising how seamlessly the Astros seem to be able to, Carlos Correa is injured. Nah, no big deal. We'll just slot in JD Davis. And oh, Jose Altuve is injured now. Oh, well, no big deal. We'll just slot in Marwin Gonzalez every day.
Right.
And Brian McCann's injured, so I guess we'll pay almost nothing to go get Martin Maldonado from a divisional rival, and just fill in there. I mean, it's just this team has so much depth and talent at this point, it's hard to say anything other than good job, guys.
Yeah, and you mentioned that they got him for basically nothing or whatever, and that segues nicely to the next deal, which is the Yankees getting J Happ for Brandon Drury and Billy McKinney. I'm a Drury fan. He's deserving of a big league spot, but this is a pretty smart deal by the Yankees, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Drury was completely superfluous on this Yankees team. I like the deal that brought him in. I have no problem with that deal that brought him in to the team when they made it to get him from the Diamondbacks early in the season. At the same time, with the emergence of Gleyber Torres and Miguel Andujar, there's you don't need him. I mean, he's not a necessary aspect to this team, but J. Happ is absolutely necessary for this Yankees team. They needed another guy who can come in and take some starts in the rotation because, Sonny Gray isn't working out and they keep having these injuries, Jordan Montgomery, Domingo Germán. It's not the best situation that they could possibly have. I like Drury as a pickup for the Blue
Blue
Jays because
Jays.
I still think he can hit at the major league level. I think he's probably having a down season this year, in part because he's been stuck at Scranton, when he really is a major league caliber player in his age 25 season, a year that I think he probably was thinking was going to be his breakout season. Instead, he's putting up numbers in Pennsylvania. I just think that this is going to be a good fit for everybody involved. McKinney was never going to get a chance in New York. They have too much outfield talent. They can't even find a spot for Clint Frazier when he's healthy. So these are two guys who are just absolute spare parts for the Yankees. And Happ is a solid starter, and they really, really needed one. So it works for everybody.
Yeah, and Drury had some health issues of his own. I believe he had blurred vision or something at some point. So hopefully he's hearty and hale and goes on to be productive, because I think we're both in agreement. He is a big league player, and yeah, solid pickup for the Blue Jays in that regard. Although again, the Yankees are not gonna miss these guys. That's why I mentioned that they kind of got him for nothing. And Hap, we haven't talked about him at all.
Right.
He might be the top starting pitcher dealt this deadline, depending on what happens elsewhere. He's an above average arm, and he's been an above average arm for years. I think he's actually kind of underrated. I feel like I saw a lot of Yankee fans dreading the Yankees acquiring him, which was odd to me because, and maybe it was just because of the expected price tag versus the actual price tag. But I mean, that Yankees rotation, excuse me, needed some help, and we're talking about a guy who has a strikeout to walk ratio over 3.5. His ERA plus is 102. Remember, the big league average for starting pitchers is like 93. So even if you're just going off ERA, this guy has been an above average starting pitcher, and he's done that for years. And I know he's older. I know he doesn't have, Noah Syndergaard style stuff, but he's effective. He's solid. You want him in your playoff rotation over some of the alternatives. And yeah, I like this deal for the Yankees. And I don't really know why people are so down on Hap, other than that, he's had a few rough starts in the past, month and a half. But hey, man, look at what Cole Hamels has done in the past few weeks and compared to what Hap has done. And maybe you'll feel a little bit better after that comparison, because, pitchers, especially guys who are not elite, sometimes go through rough stretches where they have a couple of, let's say, shaky appearances. And, in the end, things usually work out okay. Sometimes there's exceptions, but I don't see reason to believe that this will be an exception and that Hap is, just completely useless now, as opposed to just a guy going through a rough patch.
Yeah, and just think about this for a second. J Happ is older, I think, because he's in his age 35 season, he's gonna be turning 36 right after the season, that people tend to he tends to be a post type guy. But you're not supposed to have your career high in strikeouts per nine at this age in this phase of your career, especially when you're pitching in Toronto against some really talented AL East teams. I mean, this is a legit, solid, average, mid rotation starting pitcher. And I think people, it's easy to gloss over the fact because there was a lot of his career where he wasn't that. And since he's come to Toronto, he really has been a number three starting pitcher. And just because he was terrible in Houston for a few years and terrible in Philadelphia for stints, you tend to look past it.
Yeah, it's kind of a Cliff Lee situation, although to be clear, Hap is not as good as Cliff Lee looks. But, with the late blossomers, and it takes a while for the perception of them to catch up with the actuality of them. But the Yankees also made another move for an old man. They traded for Luke Voit, who is in his age 27 season, despite only having 70 big league appearances. He's a first baseman, weird offensive profile. And they got him in exchange for Chasen Shreve and Giovanni Gallegos. So do you have any thoughts on that move?
Well, it's interesting to me because I really feel like the Yankees really value having a solid major league ready first base option in case Greg Bird gets injured yet again. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I get that. Voit is a guy who's had some success in a couple of his runs in St. Louis, but he's really a quad A guy. He's not the type of guy you want to slot into a lineup regularly. It's just more of a gotta have a guy in the background. It's the same thing where they kept trying to add guys like Adam Lind and having a really nice option as a backup first baseman seems to be something that the Yankees really value. So I mean, this is the right type of guy for that role, I guess, especially since he's got options and he's not a guy that they need to have in the majors.
Yeah, it was interesting to me that they did this, only because they also have Tyler Austin. And, it's possible Austin is injured and I just missed it, but it kind of seems like a similar situation, right? Where he's not really someone you necessarily want on your big league roster, but he seems okay as, your triple A first baseman or what have you. So, interesting stuff there. I don't really have much else to add, other than the Cardinals really just said, you know what, we're not happy with our bullpen. And they just seem to, tear it apart in the span of an afternoon, so that's kind of interesting. But otherwise, yeah, let's move on to the last few moves we have, which involve veteran outfielders signing with new teams. The Rockies signed Matt Holliday, who frankly I thought was retired. I didn't expect to ever see him in the transaction logs again, but This seems like one of those favors to an old friend. See if he can show enough during the rest of the minor league season to justify a September call-up. And I don't know that he will. It's certainly hard to kind of slot in at this point of the year when you haven't played all season and try to perform. But I don't know. Maybe for nostalgia's sake, they'll give him a run in September anyway. I don't really know if you have anything to add to that.
No, I think it's exactly what you said. It's that Holiday is going to... I think Holiday will get a September call-up as long as he's moderately healthy and won't embarrass himself, and then we can all have a feel-good moment before he retires as a Rocky, as you know, he probably wants to end his career, and all his fans wanted him to end his career. So good on him for that. It is kind of weird to think about, but he spent a lot more time with the Cardinals than he did with the Rockies. Which is,
I don't think I would have guessed that. Even though it makes sense, I don't think I would have guessed that. I probably would have said he still was more with the Rockies.
Yeah, 5 years with the Rockies in the major leagues. And with the Cardinals, he was traded in 2009. So he spent part of that 2009 season. And then all of 2010 through 2016. So 7 full seasons plus change with the Cardinals. So he's definitely a guy you identify with the Rockies. But he spent more time in St. Louis, which is really weird.
And then the ever veteran outfielder alluded to is Austin Jackson, who found a home with the Mets. I'm going to be honest, I was a little surprised that it was the Mets who signed Jackson, because it would have seemed to have made sense for a team like the Braves, perhaps Cleveland, perhaps some of these ever contenders like the Phillies, who are looking for veteran outfield help, to perhaps bring him in and slot him in against lefties, or you know, use him in some kind of timeshare capacity. That said, he was really bad in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and his performance has been kind of all over the place in recent years. You know, he was effective with Cleveland last year, but before that, wasn't really good with the White Sox or Cubs. He was okay with the Mariners, but he's been up and down consistently. And we're kind of getting to the point in his career where that's not cute anymore, and you can't really bank on him being good again. So this is probably going to be an important half season for him in New York, as weird as that sounds. You know, he's going to turn 32 before camps open next year. And I don't know. I think this might be his last chance before he starts getting into the minor league deal territory, where it's possible he spends most of his years in triple, most of his time rather, in triple A. So I don't know. What are you expecting here? What are you hoping for from Austin Jackson?
I am hoping the Mets don't play him very frequently. I like Jackson as a player. I think he's a really good fifth outfielder to have on your team. But the Mets really need to let Brandon Nimmo and Michael Conforto, when Conforto's healthy, he just happened to pick up another injury, so I don't know how long that's going to be. But they have to let these guys play, and they have to let them play in center field so that they can figure out who's going to be the center fielder for this team in 2019. If one of these two guys can handle the defensive position regularly. They're both much better players than Austin Jackson at this point. They need to let Jeff McNeil play. They don't need to let Jose Bautista play. They certainly don't need to let Jose Reyes play. But they need to get some playing time for these guys like Luis Guillorme and Jeff McNeil and maybe some of the guys from the minor leagues. I mean, Pete Alonso has been due to be called up for quite some time now. I mean, even if you're going to really, you got to either do something with Dominic Smith. If you're going to try him in the outfield, try him in the outfield. It's going to be embarrassing. Don't do it. But if you're going to try it, you should try it at the major league level and let him try to hit. But bringing in more veterans, they brought in Matt Dendecker to play center field for a while. That's stupid. They're bringing in Austin Jackson to play center field for a while. It just doesn't seem like it's a good fit. They need to let their young guys play because the season is a wash. So bringing in more veteran help is a very Mets thing to do and seems to me very stupid.
And it's weird to me. I guess the one way that the Jackson deal would have made sense is if they were planning to trade Bautista, who conceivably has a little bit of value. You're not going to get anything great in return for him, but given that you gave him, like, you know, nothing to have him on the roster so far, and he's produced admirably, honestly, based on, you know, the expectations, it would seem to make sense, you know, trade him and then use Jackson as your veteran right-handed outfield option. Sure, whatever. But, yeah, it's just weird how they seem to handle these things where they bring in a veteran and then they give them way more playing time and way more deference than they should. And I agree, they should be playing guys like McNeil and Smith. And even if you don't believe that they are average big league players or will be on your big league roster in a year's time, you know, Jose Bautista and Austin Jackson and God, I hope not Jose Reyes are going to be on your roster in a year's time either. So
this is the thing, like, you know, when you I'm thrilled Jose Bautista is playing as well as he did, especially the fact that he can't seem to hit for power anymore and still is a productive offensive player and playing some decent defense. It's really cool. And Bautista's a fun guy. I'm glad he's playing well. But the Mets are not the team that should be playing a guy like this. The Mets are a team that should be playing their young talent. Why not move Bautista on to an American League team that needs a little bit of bump in their, you know, on base percentage? Why not, you know, move him on to the Indians or something like that? Why doesn't Austin Jackson go back to the Indians? It's weird. It's weird that the Mets are they must have been able to convince Jackson that they would play him at the major league level in order for him to take that sort of deal, I would think. So, you know, they're kind of going about things backwards.
Yeah, and also, can you build favor with your veterans, you know, these similar situations by showing that, hey, we're going to bring you in, we'll play you, let you rebuild your value, and then we'll send you to a contender? Because do you think Jose Bautista really wants to play out the rest of the string and what could be potentially, you know, his final run in the majors with the Mets, as opposed to, you know, being a bench bat with, I don't know, the Yankees could use an outfielder right now, Aaron Judge out. And some of these other contenders, again, could use a right-handed outfielder type slash, you know, a guy who could maybe fake it at third base once a month or whatever. You know, isn't that a way to build favor with veterans, to trade them to contenders, to take care of them? I just don't really understand why you wouldn't trade him.
I certainly think it's possible that you could. It's also possible that he'd rather play every day and try to establish his value as opposed to being a bench bat because he wants to come back next year. So I could see a position where the player would want to stay with the bad team because the bad team is committed to playing him every day. But at the same token, I don't know with Bautista, I don't know his heart or his mind, but if it were me, I would rather be fighting for that playoff spot by being the, you know, the last guy on the bench for a team like the Yankees or a team like the Indians or the Astros. even the Mariners. Yeah, the Astros. Yeah. The Astros could use a bump over Kyle Tucker. I'm not sure they should sit Kyle Tucker because he's probably the future and the sample size has been small, but boy, has he been terrible.
Yeah, and I'm fine giving Tucker more playing time, but, you know, if they were to make an upgrade, you know, Bautista would conceivably make some sense for them. And so would Jose Martinez, who, you know, that's a topic for another time, but that's a really interesting case study on how baseball has changed, because being a good hitter is no longer enough to get you a spot in the lineup, even on disappointing teams. It's kind of crazy to think about. But, yeah, so that's basically the show for this week. I think the only thing we didn't touch on that we had planned to touch on was the Miguel Sano promotion. And, boy, I don't know if we have the energy to address that situation at this point.
Heck no. It remains to be seen if he'll be any good. But, yeah, it's something that certainly happened.
So that's the show. The next time we talk, I believe it will be after the trade deadline, and we're gonna probably have some more moves to talk about. Gonna be another trade heavy show, so hopefully everyone enjoys the deadline, doesn't get too stressed, doesn't get too bored, and that we maybe see a surprise move or two, because it's always fun to have those pop up. And we'll see what the deadline brings. So looking forward to it, Brian. Pretty sure you're looking forward to it as well, and Sean Brody is somewhere out there listening to the latest Panic at the Disco soundtrack, I imagine. So what he's looking forward to, I don't know, because I cannot relate to today's youth, folks. So that's the show. You can find all of Brian's work at Baseball Prospectus. You can find my work at cbssports.com/MLB. We can't find Brody, so neither can you. And you can find the DFA podcast on Twitter and on all the streaming apps and programs and websites that I don't know of. So thank you for listening. And again, enjoy the deadline.